Session number 24825, Rule 5.
This is the third reel of a taped interview with Arthur Leggett in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 29th of the 1st, 2003, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Now, from the last interview, we were talking about the fact that one of your main concerns, having been taken prisoner of war, was that you weren't going to be able to tell Mum. Well, what would you tell Mum? Obviously, you couldn't tell Mum.
That is the key point, I think. You couldn't tell Mum. Somehow a fella always looks up to his Mum as being a strong member of the family. I suppose because Dad's always earning a living and Mum's always there to look after the kids. And there was no way I could tell her what had happened so that she couldn't pass it on to the family, friends, relatives. And they would know there had been a rather horrendous battle, and no doubt they were worrying about how I had fared in that event.
In relation to being taken prisoner of war, people have talked about the sense of guilt.
I had no sense of guilt. My main sense was one of disgust. I felt that we had been sold down the river, to use an American expression. We had been through an evacuation of Greece, which meant that all our main weaponry had been abandoned and left. We had no artillery. We had absolutely no aircraft support, whereas the enemy's aircraft was overhead all day, every day, and there was just no way we were going to fight a battle there and win it. Although we went close to it, but all we had as far as weaponry went was our rifles, Bren guns. We never even had a base plate for our mortar. So we just had nothing to really fight a war with, and I felt that we had been abandoned, and I was a bit disgusted with the situation generally. Particularly having a slight knowledge of Gallipoli and so on, which was a failure, and the same tactics were tried again in this war that we were involved in to no useful purpose.
I'm interested, obviously, the concerns that you might have had in relation to the wider war. Here, Germany seems to be winning on all fronts at this stage.
This is right, because I'm not quite sure now, but I know we're on Crete. When we heard the Hood had been sank, well, the Hood to us was a symbol of British power. I understand Japan had come into the war at that stage. It's not quite clear there, but I think Japan entered the war around that period of history. And, of course, the Germans had decided to attack Russia, and there were quite a few of us who said, well, that will be the end of Germany.
Right, so it was Russia that gave you hope.
Yes, because I knew enough that what Napoleon had gone through and conquerors right throughout history had tried to overtake Russia, and it was just too big, vast for them to handle, especially with winters the way they are there.
How did you, you mentioned that you felt as though you'd been sold down the river or sent down the river, how did you see your commanders at this point?
Oh, they were. I thought of them always in a high light, because they in turn were simply carrying out orders which had been handed on to them. Some of the higher educated officers, of which there was quite a few in our battalion, they had a pretty good idea of what the situation was, more than what a working class character like myself would have. And they endeavoured to shelter the men as much as they could from the events. For example, when Retimo area capitulated. The officers didn't take to the hills. They stood there, got the men around them, put them in the picture, told them what the situation was, then said it's every man for himself. But they made it quite clear what the situation was.
Well, these are immediate officers, obviously. Yes. In relation to the higher up, Churchill, for instance.
Oh, well, Churchill, it's a strange thing about Churchill. Everyone looked up to him. He was a symbol of the empire, and I'm afraid we looked at him in that way. But of course, my comments these days are a little tarnished because he made some horrible mistakes. And these, of course, are history, and we see them looking back. But at the time, I must confess, we felt as though we had been let down by people like Churchill.
Obviously, the situation, the realisation that you were now a prisoner of war, how did you look to the future at that time, the immediate sort of future?
Oh, bewilderment, but determination. Those are the two main things that I can recollect. We were bewildered because we just did not know what was going to happen to us. I mean, there they were, Germans right beside you, 6 feet away. Well, up until then, they had been the enemy, but there they were. They were fellow human beings, but they had different leadership, different attitudes, and we knew some of the atrocities that had been committed. So you were bewildered. You did not know what was going to happen to you, but you were determined to live. It's a funny thing. You hang on to life right as far as you can go, and that's how I felt anyway.
In relation to the situation, obviously now POWs, how were you treated immediately? What happened initially?
Well, quite a few things. Well, we were rounded up, as I mentioned, on the beach on the far side of Crete. We were counted 1,000 times. I think the Germans can't count for nuts because of their language and their numerical setup. But after they had come to a satisfactory conclusion amongst themselves, we were then marched, and we marched far into the night. One group of paratroopers would take you to a village where you would be recounted several times by another group and moved on to the next village. So although the actual soldiers were not marching, the German soldiers were not marching far, we marched all through the night from one village to the other till we eventually finished up back at the airstrip at Retimo, which we had been defending.
What were the conditions like there at Retimo?
Oh, it was rough. We slept in a vineyard. Retimo was not the first night. I recollect another night where you just laid down a paddock and slept. That's all there was, and guards were stationed around the perimeter. So it was just like a herd of sheep with a few shepherds on the outside.
Food?
None whatsoever. And by the second day, it was beginning to get a bit rough. And
in relation to Crete, you know, people talk of the heroism of the locals and the way they helped quite often, risking their lives in many respects. How did they treat you? How did they see you being marched off?
We did not see a great many of them on Crete itself. I think a lot of them were laying low, keeping out of sight, because some atrocities had happened in the area around Retimo, and I think the Greeks were laying very low. For example, during the paratroop landing, the police academy at Retimo armed itself and took to the Germans, and after the capitulation, 80 of those recruits from the police force were marched down to the beach and machine gunned. So that would put a damper on any activity that the locals may have had at that time.
What about the situation in relation to the fighting that had gone on? It had been very bitter in some instances. Did that mar the way the Germans were treating you at all, do you think?
No, it did not. I must admit, his paratroopers were a fine type of individual. Outside of all that they had done, they were a fine type, but the German Wehrmacht had a system there. The men in the front line were the pick of his nation. Then from there, We were eventually finished up back at Kenya, where we were put into the civilian prison. We were under the care of paratroopers then. And in due course, well, we fed the minimum of food, just enough to keep us going. And of course, we only had the clothes we stood up in when we were captured. You had nothing else. It was a bit rugged. We spent several weeks sleeping on cement floors and such like. Eventually came time to move us from Crete across to the mainland. Well, we finished up being herded into an old cold hulk. There's no other way to describe it. We just pushed it down. They just kept cramming it down into the hole below deck. And it was already filthy, and we were filthy, and we got dirtier and dirtier in that boat. They changed their type of guards, and these men were a bit rough. They were rugged. They seemed to have a style of changing the front line to those just behind who were a little bit different. There were those behind them who were great adherents to Hitler's philosophy, and they were a bunch of mongrel bastards, and that's just putting it politely. So by the time we were taken up to Salonika, we got off the ship. Well, some men never even had pants or boots or anything to wear. We were marched through the street to an old Greek barracks, which obviously had not been occupied for many years. The Germans had put a barbed wire fence around this whole area, and we were herded in there. And it was a bug-ridden, filthy hell of a place. They had a knack of chasing everyone out of the barracks in the morning, out onto a bitumen-covered parade ground, and there you would stay all day in the heat, no food, no water, nothing. It was just their rotten method of debilitating a man, killing his spirit, and so on. And that was the type of guard. They would shoot you at the drop of a hat for the slightest provocation, and things were very grim then, because at that stage, we were nothing. We had been captured in battle, but we had not as yet been registered with the International Red Cross. Therefore, you could vanish and no one would know anything about it. So you could be shot, and that was all there was about it.
And that obviously, that must have been a concern to you. What did you understand of the laws of the Geneva Convention in relation to being taken prisoner?
Nothing. I'm afraid we were not educated in that line of thought, because prisoner of war life, if you're on one side, it's negative. And you don't encourage negative thinking amongst the troops. We were never going to lose a battle, never ever. And I'm afraid the idea of being a prisoner of war just never entered your head until such times as it actually happened. And then it took a lot of comprehending.
So when was it that you started to realise that possibly being a prisoner of war, at least you were now registered?
Well, to continue with this tape, in due course, we were shoved, I think it was 40 men, into one of those famous trucks which everyone knows about. We were locked up in there we were given a loaf of bread and a tin of meat as our rations for 6 days and six nights. Men were in a bad way because of the treatment which we had been going through. Some had dysentery, some had diarrhea, some had malaria. We were just herded into these trucks and we were locked in there for 6 days and six nights. It was a bit of a horrendous trip.
How long after your capture?
I think it must have been at least a couple of months. I can't recollect clearly, but it was quite some time anyway. I suppose Germany was short of traffic and so on. It had to look after its own army, attend to them. And we were inside the barbed wire, so we were right if a few of us died, that's tough. And I suppose they were reinforcing their own situation first.
Had anyone talked to you about what was going to happen to you?
No, nothing. No, you had no idea. And gradually your spirit went down, and you lost interest in a lot of things. I know, for example, in these Greek barracks that we were kept in, I had reached the stage personally, if I was sitting down on a floor, I couldn't stand up. I would have to crawl to a wall and climb up a wall and hang on to that until the pain in my head let go and my eyes could focus again. So I must have been suffering very badly from malnutrition, and I assume there's many more like it. We had nothing, no bedding, nothing, only what we were captured in. Therefore, you were spending your night laying on a cement floor. And I know I got big bruises at the base of my spine and on my hips because there was just no padding to lay on. We survived this trip. We finished up, the group I'm with, at Moosburg, outside of Munich. And we arrived there at the end of a day in the dark. We got out of the truck. So I remember jumping out of this truck and landing flat on my face on the ground. I couldn't understand how I'd fallen there. And I eventually opened my eyes, looking straight into a snarling Alsatian dog and an equally snarling guard. But a couple of my mates picked me up and dragged me along. Inside the compound, we were put in a big barracks and just settled down for the night. There was bunks in there, with just a palliasse on them. There was no bedding. Next day, we were taken up to the shower rooms, and there our heads were shaved clean, which was a good thing. We were taken into a big shower room with good hot water, and as I say, our heads were shorn, but we could scrape the filth off your skull that had been there for months, and you just scraped away. We scraped away at each other, laughed at each other's bones sticking out here and there and all that sort of stuff. Then we were registered with the International Red Cross, and the clothes we had on were taken, and I don't know what happened to them, but we were issued with clean uniforms, but parts of uniform that come from every conquered nation that the Germans had overrun. I know I had a French coat, Polish pants, and Dutch boots, and this is how we were dressed at this stage. And I had a French hat, and that's how we were dressed at that particular time. And, the big camps, because they had thousands of men in it of all nations, but they kept the English-speaking personnel together, which was a good thing for us. They kept the Australians together, and the English, we were all together, which helped boost morale, especially as things began to look up. It was in this camp that we got our first Red Cross parcels, which, of course, was the mainstay of our whole existence for the next 4 years.
In relation to what we up until this time, how had you managed to keep yourselves going, do you think?
Comradeship was one thing. You see, the island capitulated, and those that were left from a platoon hung together because you had been mates for many years. And I know in our particular signal platoon of the 2nd 11th Battalion, I think there was 8 of us hanging on together. And this helped considerably. A certain amount of spiritual belief. At that time, I did have good, strong spiritual convictions, and I think they helped too, because you were convinced that you were going to live through all this. But, there are other men who are atheists, and they had the same idea, though. So, it's a peculiar thing. While we're on the topic of religion, we were blessed and told we were fighting for God, King and country, but I remember being knocked unconscious by a German whose belt on his buckle had an engraving on its "God's with us," and I thought, that's funny. I thought he'd on our side, which makes you think a bit for the rest of your life.
I'm interested to talk about that. Obviously, the morale, keeping your morale up, particularly at the lowest point where you have been malnourished for some time.
Well, that again was sustained by a spirit of comradeship. And in due course, the little group of platoon comradeship expanded so that you became Australians. And this was a big, strong feeling that we always had. We were Australians. And somehow, amongst the German population, it garnished a certain amount of respect because we were Australians. And I don't know why. Probably because we came from so far away. I remember Well, I'm digressing a bit, but we did come from a long way away from Germany, and a lot of them had no idea what Australia was like. I know back in 41 or early 42, there were some terrible bushfires in Victoria, and one of the Germans asked me, well, what would happen to all the lions and the elephants and the tigers in that country? That's the knowledge they had of Australia. Where were we?
Well, I'm interested to talk about this comradeship a little more, yep. And particularly the use of jokes. You mentioned here you are having a shower and you're laughing at each other.
Oh, yes, yes. That's one of those things. You have a good sense of humour, you maintain a sense of humour. And I can say, too, in the main, the brutality stopped when we got to the Stalag 7A. We were a different type of setup altogether from there onwards. But we did maintain a sense of humour. There would always be something to laugh about, and some trivial thing, but it did happen. For example, it sounds rough, but they had communal toilets. And at the end of the day, every nationality in the world would be there talking over the day's problems, talking about how they were going to win the war and all this, and there'd be about 30 men sitting on pedestals all around up and down this building, and that struck me as rather funny, because they were so. In that way, we developed from furfigrams to latrinograms, but they're all rumours, of course, of no value, no substance.
Obviously, though, those rumours helped you to keep going?
For a while, but eventually, well, when I use the word eventually, I was there for 4 years, so you eventually just, come off it. You knew damn well that liberty was going to be when somebody from the opposite side appeared with a bayonet and a rifle and said, you're free. That's the only truth, isn't it?
As I understand, in relation to the Geneva Convention, POWs must be treated decently, removed from the field, taken care of, have rations no less than garrison troops, must have, receive attention, medical attention.
Yes, right. In the main, they conform to that. There were acts of brutality. They cropped up. It depended on the individual. You would get the individual soldier who was a mongrel because that's his nature. You get a few of those.
Would this have been earlier on?
Earlier on, but occasionally it cropped up during the next 4 years. Depended where you were. See, Germany, I may have mentioned, from what I could see, was divided, in as much as there was the people up north around Berlin and so on. They were under the impression they were going to win the war. And then down in Munich, you got the Bavarians, who weren't a bit interested in what went on up the north of Germany. And then further south was the Austrians, who didn't give a damn about either of them. And your treatment depended to a certain degree on the locality where you were working.
Are you able to give us examples at all of brutality you may have received yourself or witnessed?
Not always from the guards. I know we had one fellow, something went wrong. We're getting on a bus to go to work. We weren't, the men were, and the bus driver took to him, hit him with a spanner, and he fell off and hit his head and was killed. That was one example of brutality. There were some big firms where the working men pretty solidly, and the foremen there were a bit brutal. They would punch a man if they felt like it. And later, in the coal mines, there were several events of brutality in Poland where we were working underground. The German shift bosses were a bit keen on getting out production, which I suppose they were committed for, and they were a bit brutal in the way they went about that. If you weren't shoveling hard enough, you got a bit of a belting up there too.
In relation to the situation of becoming a POW, how did you then start to sort of settle in? How did you sort of get used to the idea?
Well, in the main camp there, Stalag 7A, eventually we were put into groups of about 500, I suppose, and taken to Munich. And in Munich, there was smaller prison camps, which were POW camps. They weren't prison camps, they were prisoner of war camps. They were set up with good solid barracks, with bunks, about 18 men to a room. They had a table down the centre with forms on either side. They had a stove to keep it warm, electricity, and from there onwards, things were got a lot better, and your morale lifted as your health increased.
In relation to the average day, how did you spend it?
Oh, I was...
You talk about Moosburg, maybe we could go from that point.
Oh, well, Moosburg was pure boredom. There's nothing you could do. All it was a parade in the morning, a Czech parade in the morning. There'd be another one at night. There were certain rules and regulations where you weren't allowed to go, and the day was really somewhat monotonous. There's not much you could do. We had not received anything to occupy our minds, such as books or games or anything of this nature, and it was just a period of monotony.
And how long did this period last?
I think, if I recollect, well, maybe 6 weeks. Put it that way, about 6 weeks, because the Germans were very keen on getting you out to work.
What are the conditions that you were now in? You mentioned
in Moosburg. Oh well, the layout of Moosburg was very similar to what people are aware of in the concentration camps. What makes the difference, of course, is the treatment. It's not the buildings. You follow me? So the POW buildings were laid out much the same. They were big barracks in rows. And there was barbed wire fences to shepherd one nation off from the other. And but facilities were there. There was a cookhouse there, not that there was much to cook. And there was a shower room there. You could have a shower, you could keep yourself clean. It was up to you, of course. And they gradually got the NCOs in charge of a group of men. And in this way, the men were in groups, and well, you start to get your pride back because you were being clothed a bit better, because we had been through a very horrendous period and it didn't take much to improve on that. And that's generally how life was in Moosburg camp. So it was just a monotonous time.
And the dealing with this boredom, was it difficult to sort of maintain sort of good relations with each other?
Oh, yes, yes. You never... There was always a slight... Some fellows, well, all fellows, have their down moments, put it that way, and they liked it to flare up a bit. But in the main, we realised, everyone else would realise what the problem was and would be tolerated. And there wouldn't be any punch-ups, put it that way. That was just not considered. And so you supported each other through this boredom, but we're all part of it. It was all comradeship right through the lot.
What of the use of officers? Your officers try and maintain discipline?
Now, right from the very start, officers were separated from the men. They went to different camps entirely, and they were kept locked up as best the Germans could keep them locked up. NCOs, that's non-commissioned officers, sergeants didn't have to work if they didn't wish, but quite a few of them volunteered to go out to the work camps in an administrative capacity, so that they in effect were liaison between the Germans and the men in the camp, which was a good idea. This also applied to sergeant majors. They could do the same thing. But sergeant majors and sergeants were not obliged to work anyway, not in the beginning. And corporals, yes, they were sent out with the rest of us.
What of the camp commanders?
The German camp commanders, the one that we had in Munich, they were military, but they were very fair. If you behaved in a military-like manner, you were treated accordingly. German officers like to be saluted, which is a bit hard for the boys to do, but at the same time the German officers have the right to demand it. But again, there would be an officer as a camp commandant, the doctor, the German doctor who called regularly, he would be an officer. Well, okay, you show them respect, because there would be German sergeants and under officers and so on down the line in rank. But the top officers, we didn't see a great deal of them, put it that way.